Hello all, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, the podcast where big books make big men hard. I'm joined by my fellow big book boner bros, Hans Berger and Patrick Barney. My name is Chris Momberg. Before I get into setting up this episode, Patrick has an announcement. Patrick?
I just wanted to announce that I've got a short story coming out in April, should be April 1st, through a lit mag called Asterion. That's A-E-S-T-E-R-I-O-N, Asterion lit mag. It should be available by the time this podcast goes live. It's like March 8th now, and when it goes up, it'll be after April, probably. It's about all-around loser, deadbeat dad type of figure who undergoes a fucked-up psychological experiment for money. That's what it's about. So if that interests you, check it out.
Thank you for that. What's it called again?
Oh, I didn't even say that. The Mirror.
The Mirror. Patrick Barney and Asterion. Yep. Say that again.
Asterion Lit Mag.
Asterion Lit Mag. Awesome. Congratulations, sir.
Yeah, thanks.
So in today's episode, we're going to discuss the first part of Roberto Bolaño's sprawling epic, 2666, published 2004, a year after his death. We'll be following this episode up with two more episodes on 2666, the next episode tackling parts 2 and 3. And the third and final episode on 2666 tackling parts 4 and 5. If you listened to last episode, you'll know that the plan was to discuss parts 1, 2, and 3 in this episode today, and then 4 and 5 in the next episode. So only two episodes total was the plan for 2666. But I really, really, really had a hard time writing the summaries and questions for the first three parts of the novel together. And after discussing it with my co-hosts, we decided to switch things up a bit. Before I talk about part one, I think I need to spend some time setting up a frame for the whole book as a whole. Each part of the novel is distinct enough that Bolaño left instructions for them to be published as separate novels. That obviously didn't happen. But you can understand
why eventually.
Sorry, it did happen eventually.
Yeah, you can also buy it as a collection of separate volumes.
Money grabbing. That's what that is.
Sorry to interrupt.
It's good to know. Well, you can understand why they can be disseminated as separate novels when you read them. They have different primary characters, different tones, and spend long stretches of time in different parts of the world and parts of history. At the center of all these threads, though, is the hundreds of women murdered in the late 1990s in the Mexican factory city of Santa Teresa, just across the border from the U.S. Santa Teresa, by the way, is a very very faithfully fictionalized Juarez, where hundreds of femicides occurred over that same period. But we don't really get much of either Santa Teresa or the femicides in part one. In fact, we don't even hear the words Santa Teresa until we're 100 pages in. And we don't hear about the femicides occurring until there's only around 30 pages remaining, and then pretty much only in passing. And this is honestly why I had a hard time preparing for this podcast, because if we were to talk about parts 1 through 3 all at once, it would be hard to honor the extraordinary patience with which we approach the subject in this novel when you kind of take the novel as a whole, all 5 parts together. It feels like Bolaño is doing this on purpose, and I really wanted to talk about why. If that is something that we can disentangle a little bit. So before we talk about it, though, here's what takes place in part one, which is called the part about the critics. Part one follows 4 European academics who have fallen in love with the novels of Benno von Arcimboldi, an enigmatic German author of uneven success but consistent renown across the European countries, where his work has been translated. These academics are Manuel Espinosa, Jean-Claude Peltier, Piera Morini, and the sole female of the group, Liz Norton. Each is their own version of vehement Archimbaldi fan, engaging enthusiastically in the academic practice of shitting on any author they deem lesser than Archimbaldi, and attacking any academic who doesn't value Archimbaldi as much as they insist that he deserves. They also work doggedly to elevate Archimbaldi's status with their own translations of his work and articles on his genius. Three of the critics eventually form a love triangle: Espinosa, Peltier, and Norton. The tensions of this triangle are threatening to break the group up when news that Archimbaldi may be visiting the city of Santa Teresa reaches them. They decide to travel there to look for him, as Archimbaldi does not make public appearances, nor has he ever conversed with any of them, though each has made him and his work the focus of their very existences. Marini, who has MS, bows out at the last minute due to health reasons, but the other three fly into the U.S. and cross the border into Santa Teresa to look for Archimbaldi. Needless to say, they find Bupkis. Santa Teresa isn't just a major city. It's entirely strange and illegible to the European academics. They wander around mostly like complete fucking idiots. But while they don't find Archimbaldi, each is changed by the experience in different ways. Norton flies back early. She seems more aware of the city's awfulness, perhaps because she's a woman. Once in Europe, she realizes that she actually loves Marini, then dumps Peltier and Espinosa for him. Espinosa, upon being dumped, or taking the news of being dumped, takes up with a young Mexican woman named Rebecca, who sells serapes and rugs in the public market. He awkwardly courts her, uses her for sex, and then leaves. Peltier finally seems to find maybe a bit of peace, reading the same books by Archimbaldi in the hotel in Santa Teresa, over and over again until he returns to Europe and his life there too. So not really anything about the femicides in part one, not really. Pretty overtly about academia, and I have to say it's maybe my favorite anything about the particularly petty lives of academics. Part one of 2666 feels like the closest thing I've read to capturing what is kind of what is both sublime and awful about the parasitic relationships between academics and their subjects, specifically academic critics and their artistic subjects. Which leads me to my first question, actually. Academia is definitely a target here, but I don't think it's purely a target for ridicule. Maybe you feel differently, guys. But what points do you take away from part one about academia, the part about the critics? And does the things it has to say about academia read true?
Well, I think that, I mean, there are a lot of different themes in the book as a whole, right? But one thing that I think it comes back to a lot is the ways in which contemporary life, roughly defined, like 20th, 21st century bureaucratized, technologicalized life, the ways in which that suppresses, redirects, channels, urges toward violence and dominance, right? Kind of the linkage of sex and violence and the sort of more primal push to dominate violently, or kind of to, you know, like sadistic impulses that we hide, right? And I think one thing that you see throughout the book is kind of the tension between that that suppressive or repressive or redirecting kind of nature of contemporary life and ways in which it either kind of pushes to the surface or is allowed to push to the surface. I'm trying to just focus on part one here because a lot of the really kind of core thematic stuff is in part four, right? But like it... I mean, I think among other things, right, the portrait here is of academia as kind of one channel through which the kind of violent domineering impulse in human nature can be redirected, maybe not that productively, but at least harmlessly, right? You know, there's kind of a sense mm-hmm. of gladiatorial violent conflict in these academic conferences, but it is ultimately something that is a kind of a harmless dissipation of the of those energies, right? And the arcs of so many of these characters involve them kind of seeing that energy in themselves actually sort of begin to come out in a more distinct way and responding to that in different ways, right? And so I think the main idea that we get of academia here basically is as kind of a proxy for darker aspects of human nature, and at best, I think, an imperfect one in terms of one that, like any kind of redirecting mechanism or proxy is fallible and potentially can break down rather easily.
I don't think this is exclusive to what you said, Hans, but I kind of saw it slightly differently, but I feel like it's probably the same thing. But I feel like I started to grasp the first part right around the time Espinoza and Peltier beat up the cabbie.
Mm-hmm.
Is kind of where I felt like I started to understand that, you know, these, we've got this contrast between, you know, the cabbie is a Pakistani guy who overhears Espinoza, Peltier, and Norton discussing their love triangle. And the Pakistani, you know, he does say some offensive things, like, you know, Norton's a whore and Espinoza and Peltier are her pimps. But then Espinoza and Peltier, like, call him out for being a Muslim misogynist and all this, and they beat the hell out of him, right? They freak out and beat the hell out of him. And I thought that was an interesting contrast with how Espinoza and Peltier try to control their relationship with Norton as a very intellectually, like, mm-hmm. you know, we're going to continue on in this triangle for a while, but eventually, Norton, you have to make a choice between Peltier and Espinoza. And of course, you know, that, you know, Chris, you said you called, like, academia a proxy for our violent or passionate nature, and maybe this is like an example of how that proxy plays out, where, you know, people try to be intellectual about something, but ultimately, you know, the tension breaks down and violence erupts. So maybe, you know, I don't necessarily think I'm saying anything that you didn't say, Chris, Hans. I'm just pointing out where I saw that kind of thematic core happening, I guess, is what I would say.
I'll jump in to say, I think there is also, for me at least, an aspect of the academic means of channeling these sort of competitive, more primal urges, I guess, that also seems to make the academics feel silly, right? The fact that the substance of these battles is so removed from the harsh realities that, you know, persist all around them feels like it kind of, you know, you say that academia is kind of harmless, but it feels, at least when we kind of learn of the femicides in Santa Teresa kind of through a sort of hungover haze. I don't remember which one, Espinoza or Peltier, is like hungover and thinking back on the night before when when some people they were parting with, some grad students, I believe, brought it up. And it feels like the things that they've filled their lives with are diminished next to this very real thing. And so I'll say in addition, maybe it's harmless. Maybe nothing. You can sort of channel your these energies into is going to be authentic when measured against like real conflict and real suffering. But it feels to me like academia is sort of being made fun of sometimes, and sort of I love that idea though, Hans, of like these primal urges sort of like living like underneath and always being there. That scene with the cabbie right after Peltier and Espinoza and Norton are described as just having orgasmed,
right.
Not literally, but figuratively orgasmed from this experience, from this violent very irrational outburst. And they beat the shit out of him, and then they take his car and leave, and then ditch the car. And so, like, you know, it's not even really clear that he recovers. Like, they beat the absolute shit out of him. So right. It's a there is like an incredible like darkness, even beneath this sort of, I don't know, these silly convictions and livelihoods that these people have made for themselves.
There's a very telling detail in that scene, I think. And it's a good example, I think, of the ways in which Bolaño is almost always using some amount of dark humor to sort of leaven this, right? Because I think, like, just listening to the plot summary that you read and to the ways that we've been talking about this book, it sounds like it would be kind of a drag, right? And I'm sure that, you know, realistically, I suppose many people would regard it as kind of a drag, particularly some of the stuff that's coming. But there's this kind of, for me at least, and this is, I guess, a very subjective thing that's not really like subject to argument, but there's a way in which there's always some component of just a little bit of surrealism and dark humor and these kind of, you know, it's written in mostly a pretty kind of straightforward style, but every now and again there'll be this weird digression into like a 3-page long sentence or something, you know. And that, I mean, that's a lot of why I've always been fond of it. I think it strikes a very effective balance between, to some extent, honestly, thematically, kind of making its point with the sledgehammer, and also having still, I think, some sense of subtlety and complexity and mystery and maybe ideas that are sort of flitting around the corners, you know, particularly when you consider the whole thing in totality. But all that's kind of a long digression. I just wanted to call attention. There's a sentence there where they say when they're beating the cabbie, one of them says, "This is for Salman Rushdie," even though none of them like Salman Rushdie, right?
Right.
And it's just so obviously like this kind of, it's them using their ostensible values as this pretext for something that just touches some suppressed part of them in a deeper way.
What is part one about if we do talk about in isolation? I kind of jumped into the academic theme because I think that is, so overt. It's like the title of the part. But is there more? And I do kind of want to try to talk about it in isolation, but it's hard to, I don't want to forget this. Maybe it's something we return to later in discussing the rest of the book. I don't know if we have the discipline to do that. This part, we don't hear about Santa Teresa until 2/3 of the way through it, and then, you know, barely hear about the femicides. What is Bolaño doing by leading us so measuredly, so meanderingly, so sedately to what will be the core of this book? And what is, you know, apart from the academia, what is the subject of part one? What work is it doing?
Well, I think that, I mean, off the top of my head, there's probably a lot that it's doing, right? Because the the scale of this work is a very distinct quality, and I think the slowness of coming to the ostensible subject is an element of that scale, and there's probably a lot that it does. The first thing I can think of is that it, like, the real-life city of Juarez, the real-life murders there, why are those shocking, right? Among other things, they're shocking because they're happening in the context of this kind of economic liberalization that was supposed to bring prosperity, right? And in the long run, perhaps did, but certainly at the time this was written, did not, right? And happening very close to the U.S. border in, you know, maybe not technically all the way developed nation, but one with much more of an infrastructure of law and technology and society than places where you would think that some kind of violent lawlessness like this would happen, right? The point of all that being just that, like, it exists, both the fictional and real city, I think, kind of exist as this affront to the self-conception of contemporary Western technological society, right? And I think to really get a sense of that, you have to kind of start with the thing that is being affronted, right? If you just went into the long descriptions of series of murders in part four, I think that has a very different aesthetic effect than if you spend some time thinking about the thing that is, you know, disrupted or affronted or undermined by the awfulness of this other thing. And there's an effect, I think, aesthetically where, and again, I know I'm not really sticking to part one here, which I swore I would do, but there's, you know, it's like there's an aesthetic effect where it's like you're being, it's like Santa Teresa and the murders are this like giant iceberg coming very slowly out of the fog, you know, and you see it just a tiny bit from an enormous long ways away. Or like it's a whirlwind and you're on the very edge of it and you're being sort of like through parts one to three kind of gradually dragged in almost against your will, right? I guess one of those is a thematic effect, one is an aesthetic effect, but a couple initial thoughts.
Kind of Heart of Darkness-y, where, you know, where we're working toward is pretty dark, and to appreciate how dark it is, if you start there, then that's interminable. It doesn't mean very much. You kind of have to get the spectrum to understand, like, just how bleak the center of this novel is. Patrick, this is the first time through 2666 for you. Were you bored out of your gourd with part one, or kind of waiting for it to kick into gear?
I was definitely, like, there were definitely parts that bored me. Like, I think my attention started to get caught, like, when the love triangle became the center of the plot for this first part, because that was something that I could be like, okay, so this is about a love triangle, and then, you know, I was kind of interested in seeing what would happen between, you know, the three of them, and then I think my attention started to wane again after the beating by the cabbie, because that's the point at which I felt like I understood, like, what was being done thematically, like we're contrasting these high-minded intellectual ideals with, you know, base violent passion, and how, you know, like this base violent passion just kind of explodes out. And I think I would have been more interested in, like, the Archimbaldi stuff, like how they're obsessed with Archimbaldi, if, Like, you know, the word oeuvre is used several times about Archimboldi's oeuvre and whatnot. And, but I'm like, it didn't seem like there was any clear picture about what the fuss is about. Mm-hmm. Like if, but, and maybe that's part of the point. Like if Archimboldi, like if the reader doesn't know what's so great about Archimboldi, because like the academics consistently fuss over how great he is, but like the central ideas or the central aesthetic importance of Archimboldi isn't really set, like exposed or explained, then that's another way in which academia seems to be ridiculed. But I wasn't like, it didn't seem like the Archimboldi stuff was, until just now, like having that thought, like I didn't know what the relevance of it was. So I wouldn't say I was like totally bored out of my mind, but I was interested at points and not interested at others. Yeah. And I don't know, with big novels like this that have, like, it seems like it's made up of vignettes a lot of the time. Like, I always get this sinking feeling that nothing is gonna like pull together and nothing is gonna matter, you know. So I'm like, there's cool parts, but I, you know. And I hope I'm wrong. I hope, like, when I read parts 4 and 5, I'm like, oh, that's what part 1 is doing, or oh, now I understand what the fuss are about Archimboldi is. But I also have the feeling like I probably won't. Like, you know, who knows? You guys know.
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually. I mean, I don't know. I certainly wouldn't advise optimism. I mean, I do think that. I do think it all fits together in interesting thematic ways, and there are questions that come out in part one that are answered in parts 4 and 5, right? Like there
right.
are, but I mean, I think one of the thematic ideas that I remember taking from it when I read it years ago was that sometimes the ostensible answer to a mystery does not, in fact, contain the satisfaction we think it will, right? Like, I do think that's a right. thematic idea of the book. So if that, which sounds to me like, I mean, a book that would make that kind of point is probably the sort of book that you would feel the sort of disappointment that you're describing. I'll just say that.
Right. Like, you know, like, thinking about, like, so we could discover who Archimboldi is, but to my mind, I assume it won't matter for any of these characters in part one. Like when it's
discovered,
I don't
think it's a spoiler
it
to
is,
say no. The characters' lives will not be. We will find out who Archimboldi is, but it will not matter to them. No.
Right. So we will find out, but it won't matter to any of these characters, and I'm not sure it'll matter to me. Is all I'm saying. You know.
I think.
But maybe. Yeah. What'd you say, Chris?
Well, I was going to say, I'd reserve judgment on that. Right. I don't know if you're not going to get plot. There's, apart from like why Archimboldi's there, you're not going to get plot resolution,
right?
I think here, you know, so.
Well, don't spoil it, you know, for me.
Yeah. Oh, for me, you mentioned the cabbie, Patrick.
Yeah.
The cabbie beating. This book has lived in my head for years. Part one has lived in my head for years. Not with the cabbie beating, but the sort of sexual relationship that develops between Espinoza and Rebecca.
Mm.
And it's interesting because reading it this time, I felt a lot less sort of hurt by it. Like for whatever reason, the first time I read this book, it felt like an older man really doing like uh the kind of committing the worst sort of like power dynamic sexual taking sexual advantage of a younger woman who's right. economically disenfranchised in a city where, you know, this sort of happens. So it's like he's dumping this he's exercising this animal not cruel necessarily, but not empathetic, not humanist animal impulse to, you know, hook up sexually with this person and then leave. And I didn't feel quite so bad about it, but it still feels to me like, I don't know. It still feels like the point at which the dark underbelly of, you know, what it is that like, propels these, for the most part, men, sort of surfacing and then, being tucked away, so that Espinoza can return and be, you know, a European critic once again. So I don't know if it sticks with you guys at all, or if it's something that is just basically another manifestation of the impulses that lead them to beat up the cabbie. But did either of you have anything to speak to about Espinoza and Rebecca?
You know, the part of Espinoza that leads him to beat up the cabbie, right? That's not just about like the impulse toward violence. It's about the impulse toward domination and the impulse toward ownership and the impulse toward kind of situational power, you know? And the thing about being who he is relative to Rebecca is he is, in some sense, a very powerful person, right? He has financial leverage. He has mobility, he has things that she doesn't. And, you know, the experience with Liz is in some sense emasculating, and he cannot act out in any sort of violent way in response to it, right? Or, you know, he can't act out violently in response to it without losing things that are core to his identity. But what he can do is, you know, find this other vehicle, the kind of poverty and trappedness of the city and the people in it allows him this other vehicle to act out these impulses temporarily. And Rebecca, as you noted, Chris, Rebecca basically knows the score, right? Because she lives in a place where the social currency of dominance is much, much closer to the surface. And is life as a critic hollow? I don't know. It seems like for Pelletier, it's not, right? Like, he has taken this experience as an opportunity to redouble that commitment. And will that commitment take him anywhere? Will it mean anything? Will it? I mean, it will if it does, and it won't if it doesn't, right? I mean, that's stupid, but it's like, it's existentialism, right? Like, Pelletier.
No, but that's a fair point. Yeah, absolutely.
It's for, like, Pelletier has said, the only way to keep the version of my humanity that I have constructed is to fully immerse myself in this thing that I have chosen as a path to contentment, and I have to do that or die, right? And Espinoza instead kind of manipulates this woman as a pressure valve, a girl, I suppose, as a pressure valve.
How old is she?
In ways that they both... I don't think it says explicitly. I'd imagine somewhere between 16 and 18. There's a reference to her being in high school, but she doesn't actually go to high school.
Right.
She's probably like over the age of consent in her municipality, I suppose, if that's any consolation.
If that means anything.
Yeah.
But I do like that comparison, like pointing out like maybe the life of an intellectual is not necessarily hollow, but Espinoza chooses dominance, and in the wake of Norton being like, fuck both these guys, I prefer the other guy, the third guy, Mariana, is that how you say his name?
Marini.
Marini? Yeah, Marini. in the wake of this, you know, Espinoza's like, well, okay, I guess I'm, you know, I'm a loser, and I guess I'll just have sex with this underage girl. And Peltier's like, well, I'm a loser, but I want to like what I like and find meaning in that. And so it does seem like Peltier's version or Peltier's response is better and more humanistic than Espinoza's.
Yeah, and I don't think that this work as a whole, and I know I'm not talking about part one again, but I think part this illuminates it very well, right? Like, you know, this is a work about the ways in which the constraints of society only barely, if at all, suppress and sublimate and redirect, like, the worst parts of human nature, right? But I don't think that it's the total pessimistic rejection of the value of those, even though it right. might seem that way at times.
But there's a craft aspect to Peltier's ending. I definitely read it as a healthier response that he's right. he's reached a point of because he after or right when all of this is occurring between Rebecca and Espinoza, Peltier is shown just basically immersing himself in the works of Arcimbaldi, Espinoza returns one day and Peltier says, he's here. He's definitely here. And we don't need, but Peltier has reached a kind of a realization. It feels like an important one too, that he doesn't need to find Arcimbaldi. It's enough to know that he's there. And, you know, Espinoza, it feels is carried a little bit by that, but is not the primary experiencer of it. He's sort of, you know, he's not the Buddha. He's getting the teachings of the Buddha in that moment. And it's interesting. There's a craft aspect that I felt kind of throughout part one, where at certain points, a character becomes more opaque. We're seeing Liz a few times. I think it's mostly Liz, but also Marini, where we're seeing them through the eyes of often Peltier and Espinoza, and it is their opaqueness that almost sort of lifts them out of the kind of frantic sort of inner turmoil of Peltier and Espinoza. And the end of part one, I see Peltier occupying that sort of vaunted space, and Espinoza's got the frantic, the human messiness going on inside of his head. And so there's, I don't know if it's simply because writing about someone who's in a bit of a flow state, or writing about someone who, you know, when they're supposed to be the enigmatic one, or writing about just actually like contentment is not actually something that that Bellania wanted, but it did feel like a kind of a card that he played a few times. Does that resonate with you, Hans?
Yeah. I don't know if I really have much to add to it. I mean, I think you're right that there are very quirky decisions here about viewpoint. And some odd, there's one moment in particular pretty early on where the narrator talks about what each of the critics is thinking in turn, and then gets to Liz and just says, as to what Liz is thinking, better not to mention
it.
You know, yeah, and, exactly. And that's the kind of moment, I think, like that's the kind of writing that gets like massaged out in a workshop, or the kind of writing where, you know, in a certain context, you're really called to account to say, like, well, what is your structure and your rationale for? And I mean, I don't know how instinctive that is versus how calculated it is, right? There's a way in which a lot of the writing here feels, he's a writer who makes a lot of decisions that intuitively feel like he's kind of running in a flow state in a way, and not like thinking out the details of things too well. But that might be, you know, a calculated effect, right? And of course, he died before the book was fully edited. And I think from what I've read of his other work, it's mostly somewhat more controlled. But I don't know that I have much to add to that, really. But it's a thing that I noticed as well.
even if there's not a great explanation, it's another one of those lines that is funny and adds to the levity, you know, in mm-hmm. a book that, well, the parts 1 through 3 didn't strike me as super depressing or anything.
Oh, maybe, get ready. Maybe, get ready, man. Well,
right.
Part 4 is a motherfucker.
I'm sure part 4 will be a motherfucker. But, you know, parts 1 through 3, strike me as, you know, being fairly funny, having some stuff that, you know, some vignettes or some extra stuff that didn't strike me as super interesting, but, you know, definitely all 3 parts contain ideas that I was interested in, and moments or you know, passages that I found pretty gripping. So,
Patrick, you said the Life of a European Critic is necessarily hollow, and you might have been just echoing what was in the, you know, the part about the critics, but it also felt like you were speaking from an authentic place. I'll ask if you felt that way, but I'll add my own sort of feelings reading this again, and it really does feel like, to be an aesthetic academic, you know, an academic of art, in this case, fiction, you are sort of picking through the ruins of another person's, like, creative genius, like, constantly, and you're just sort of living off of it. And then it's kind of your job to argue, like, no, just to beat the metaphor to death. No, Troy was the greatest city. And this is how I can prove it. Troy was way bigger than Samaria and way more important. And, but they're not actually occupying the same plane as the author. They don't even interact with him. They're not creating at the same level. They're living in the sort of dark age shadow of this thing that, you know, they are lucky enough or clever enough to benefit from financially and find purpose in. But, you know, it does feel to me like they're, you know, maybe all people are silly, but, like, it feels like they are particularly silly. Is that something that you carry from this book? And is there anything authentic in you that when you say, like, in what you say when, in terms of your own feelings, when you say that the Life of a European Critic is hollow?
Well, I definitely think all 4 of the academics, the 3 that we get the most info on, like, Marini isn't, like, we don't see him that much. But I do feel like Espinoza, Peltier, and Norton are, you know, they're definitely silly. Maybe they're not personally silly, but they do seem to be engaged in silly things quite often. Like, one example is, you know, Peltier and Espinoza kind of, like, freaking out over that guy that Norton
Pritchard,
yeah, like, they're like, he's a, you know, and they like, they want it, they're like trying to be civil, but, you know, clearly they're just jealous, you know, the giant jealous penises, right?
Flaccid jealous penises.
Yeah, flaccid jealous penises, which is funny, which is silly. But I also wonder if there's, like, is there something in the novel that points out, now this is, I don't know, I'm just kind of, this is my own feeling, like, my own feeling is that the practice of criticism is silly, but doesn't have to be. I think that it one reason that it's silly is that critics are often obsessed with minutiae that doesn't matter. I think the cultural critic Terry Eagleton like pointed it out in one of his books about like, you know, we could criticism could be important and meaningful, but like, you know, it's like trying to figure out like just, it just focuses on really dumb stuff. I forget what example he gave, but what example Eagleton gave. So that's my feeling about the life of a critic. Like, it is often silly, but it could be more meaningful if we were willing to practice criticism in more meaningful ways. And to my mind, that means trying to do a better job of responding to what an author is trying to say, rather than, you know, using a framework to interpret an author, or using a, you know, finding, trying to find contradictions in an author's work, or trying to find like unconscious prejudices or whatever. I think you guys get what I'm saying. Now, I don't know, what I don't know is if this book, like, is this book just like, yeah, academics are dumb, or at least maybe not dumb, but silly, and there's no way to make criticism better? Or is it like, yeah, academics are silly, or criticism could be practiced in a less silly way? I'm not sure about that, but I'm just kind of
Hans, responding with my own ideas. Yeah, I think it's a good question. Hans, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, to my own knowledge, to my own understanding, I think the book is much more concerned about, it's much more concerned about the devotion to literature as a kind of self-suppressing force or a civilizing force, more so than how the specifics of the action of criticism could be made more or less effective, ultimately.
Right.
I don't, even taking into account the parts we haven't read yet, I don't know that it really has much to say about the best means of criticism, right? And I think even, probably not a spoiler alert to note that the fifth part is called the part about Archimboldi, right? I don't know that we ever learn that much about the works themselves, right? I mean, I think in a way, like, the viewpoint this has about art and academia, the content of the works is mostly sort of irrelevant, I think. But I might revise that when I finish it.
And that was something that I noticed in part one, and that I already said that, like, the content of Archimboldi's work is not really explained in any way. And I actually think that was something that I would have liked, you know, but of course, you know, we're not in a workshop where I'm like, Roberto, you got to give me more of Archimboldi's work. You got to tell me what it's all about.
I think it's actually interesting to talk about it, though, because the book exists both, like, part one exists on its own and as part of a larger book.
Right.
And I find it incredibly compelling as a piece of something larger, and very lacking as something on it. Not bad, but like, we've read worse and talked about worse books.
Right.
So, like, kind of divorcing, like, not trying to rate it on a scale, but just lacking. Like, it misses stuff. Like, it doesn't contain all the stuff it needs to contain to be on its own. So it's surprising to me. I know that it was the direction from Bolaño, from what I understand in the foreword, the direction was to, for the sake of basically making as much money for his family as possible, sell these separately. But I am really glad that the people who actually put it out there decided not to do that, because I even if it is published now as separate,
I should correct volumes, what I said earlier, actually. I believe that when I said it was published as separate volumes, there are editions that are a box set of several volumes. Okay. But I don't think you can just like go on eBay and order, you know, the part about fate, you know, a la carte.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, I apologize for probably like the people who listened to the beginning of this episode thought, well, that guy doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about and shut it off. I've not got to this point to hear my correction. But
yeah,
there's
very few people.
I was so kind of blunt and arrogant.
Oh my God, 2666. That makes me feel. I think maybe takes away some of my justification for you know wanting to talk about part one on its own. But it still is something that he wanted to direct people to do. So I think it's fair, Patrick, to criticize, and I think for me my criticisms would be the same as yours, which is like if you were to kind of treat this like its own thing. It needs more,
right?
Like
it's good enough.
It's good enough that you're just, you know, and it has incredible potential. And if it was its own thing, it wouldn't be meeting
right. Potential. Right. Like if this were its own novel, and it's interesting to me that the way you phrase it, because while I was listening to this, I was thinking, well, I'll just think of this first part as its own novel, because we're clearly not going to get to anything related to Juarez. You know, we're not really, it doesn't seem like, I guess I went into it thinking more like we're going to dive right into Juarez and like the murders and all that. And then we had this kind of long thing, and it's like, okay, so let me think of this as a novel separate from the rest. And if I were thinking of it as a novel separate from the rest, I would say edit out some stuff, cut some stuff, I would say interesting, has a lot going for it, but needs some revision to make it like feel like a real contained, self-contained novel, which it's not, which I understand it's not. But
when I think about this novel, I tend to think, when I think about both the meanings and what is most impactful, I tend to think about sections 4 and 5 in a way that kind of overshadow the first three. Mm-hmm. Almost of the first three is like a series of preludes to 4 and 5, which are really kind of the meat of the book. And so I was pleased we would be isolating those portions so we could consider their meanings and events in more detail, and not let the, you know, for better or worse, right, so that we could evaluate them without the kind of big shadow of the end of the book. Having had that thought, I also wonder, I think parts 2 and 3 are probably also pretty incomplete as standalones. Do we want to just say fuck it with the plan and steamroll to the end and just talk about the whole book in 2 weeks? Or do you still want to talk about parts 2 and 3 in isolation?
We can do either. I think that to some extent, I had a hard time. Everything that I was writing was about parts 2 and 3 when, trying to like prepare for this podcast. So I kind of was almost protecting part one. And, if we're not super concerned about like not spending time with Amalfitano or fate, I think pretty much inevitably, like if we do all of them at once, we're not going to talk about them very much at all.
And I can see maybe being a virtue to like give them their own space then. I've just found that like my own comments, I'm having a very hard time not talking about the book in totality, harder than I thought of.
I don't think that's a problem. I think that like there's not really a way to slice this cake, you know, like we kind of have to talk about it in as a whole, even as we're talking about a part, but we really, I, like, like the latter parts of the book so subsume everything around them. And then part one really like gets kicked out because it's not barely about Santa Teresa at all. I don't know. This is a big, important book, and I kind of want to see if maybe we continue talking about parts two and three next time. Patrick, what are your thoughts?
You know, that since I'm the one who hasn't read it all, like I read, thinking that we were going to do one, two, or three on this whole podcast, I listened to those first three parts and then stopped. So I don't feel qualified to add a vote, to be honest. I feel like I don't know. I'm fine. So I'm just going to say you two hash it out and I will go with whatever you two want.
Let's do parts two and three next episode, and parts four and five. Just, I think, like, also to protect four and five from the effort to try and like talk about two and three. And I think it actually, like, I like the idea of that bulwark kind of really focusing us on, you know, the question of, you know, maybe I could do some work to resurface some of the things that we have talked about this episode and the next episode to really ask, like, okay, we have these, I think it's valuable to have those perspectives. Like I said, for part one, you know, like that are able to establish themselves separate from what we will develop talking about parts four and five, so that we can kind of speak back to what we talked about before. And I just don't think that's possible with this book. If we were to cover those parts together. So yeah, let's do two and three and then four and five, if you don't mind. Sorry to dominate a few episodes. I just really, like, I'll say, like, this is really Hans's book. Hans did a lot of work on this book in grad school, and
yeah, you're an expert, aren't you, Hans?
I mean, I don't want to impose my reading on the group, you know.
I think you're definitely the most expert on this book.
Well, if your reading involves your idea of, like, the ways in which violence are sublimated, humans sublimate their violent passions. If that's your central idea, at least on the first part, like, I agree with that. So I don't feel like you're
that's
dominating.
That's actually not my idea. Like, that wasn't the idea of my thesis, actually. Interestingly enough, I mean, it's tangentially connected to it, but that's the thought that I had on this read. That's not something it's not really a way that I remember thinking about it when I read it, when I studied it and wrote about it 15 years ago.
Wasn't your thesis about how 2666 is conceptually, like, based entirely on an early Genesis album?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I'll, is if it? You, when we're done, when we're
was
done
it?
With the whole book.
No, you're and lying.
I'm lying.
Yeah, Chris is lying. No, there's,
my bad.
When we're done with the whole book and we've done the whole discussion for the last parts of it, if you want, we can talk then about what my thesis is, but I really don't want to bring it in until we've kind of, till you've looked at it on your own.
Sure.
Until you've had your chance to kind of offer your own thoughts about it, you know?
I guess I was saying Hans the expert as a weird way of disqualifying my own, like, feelings for the book, but, like, this book terrifies me. Like, I legitimately, like, put it down for a long time in the middle of part four, the first time through, and I am dreading part four even now. Maybe that's why I'm splitting up this podcast. I'm just trying to put off reading part four. But even as I dread it, I think it's one of the most important books I've ever read, just for me. And so I don't know if it it's a weird thing to say, like, I'm not an expert in it, but I think this is a great American, like, all-inclusive American, the whole double continent America.
Not
North America, but yeah.
Well, Mexico is North America. Bolaño was Bolaño's Mexican, right?
I thought he was
Chilean.
Argentina.
I think he Chilean. Was native oh. Chilean and then moved to Spain and Mexico. So he lived in all those places. Probably Chilean more than anything. Most of his other works are set in Chile and have to do, I think, with Chile. Although there's some Mexico in there too.
This is a great American novel in my estimation. And so, like, you know, maybe we can kind of tease that apart, you know, and what does that mean for this to be a great American novel for me? And is it a great American novel for you guys as well? But,
but ask that question later.
We will.
Yeah.
Anything else on part one?
I think I was going to say, of all the long, boring, loosely connected novels you guys have made me read, this has been the best one, I think I was going to say. But that was just a joke that I thought about.
You know, we're going to build toward it. We're going to pit Moby Dick and 2666 against each other. We're going to have
an elimination bracket, right? Like round one will be Moby Dick versus 2666 in this arena. And then Underworld versus the Garden of Seven Twilights in another arena.
I said boring, but like, I think the second part was the most boring of the three. Like, there were parts of this one that I was definitely engaged in. And the part about Fate, number three, like, I, you know, other than the very beginning, which we'll talk about later, like, once he got into Mexico and started covering the fight and, like, uncovering stuff, I was like, man, I'm starting to get into this. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, stay tuned for our next episode on parts two, which covers Amalfitano, and then part three, another character we haven't really met yet, Fate. And then we will continue with parts four and five in the following episode. But thank you so much for listening. And if you want to reach out to Hans and really cement the fact that he totally effed up talking about the ways in which 2666 has been published, please do so. I'm not going to stand in your way. So,
I was curious if you could go on the internet and buy a t-shirt about this book. And someone who has a on Redbubble, there's a design. It says Bolaño 2666. And then in like one of those sort of like circular logos, it says, "Isn't reality an insatiable AIDS riddled whore?" my birthday is in 2 months.
Oh, man. That's a great t-shirt.
I would wear that t-shirt. I would totally wear that.
Patrick, you didn't have to say that you would wear that. Hans and I both fucking knew that.
Oh, all right.
That is obviously
something I would wear. Yeah.
Yeah. And isn't reality an AIDS riddled whore? Yeah. Well, thank you so much, listeners, and tune in next time. Thanks, guys.